Greg and I, we're going to try to lead a little bit of a discussion and summary for what's gone on over the last couple of days. I think really the purpose of this is just to get everybody to kind of refocus and think a little bit more holistically about what's gone on. Opportunity to make a couple of comments or some thoughts that might help sort of crystallize some of the outcomes of the meeting, and then sort of figure out, okay, what should we kind of put together? What sort of things do we all want to come away from the workshop with respect to how we're going to treat magnetotelluric data in the future, and just ultimately sort of advance the whole field. So this is kind of free flow. Greg and I sort of put these things together over the last couple of minutes here. But I think if we look back, if you remember what happened on Wednesday, I mean, we were very much into forward modeling and validation. And we saw a whole bunch of techniques, including finite difference, finite element, integral equation techniques, and importantly, spurred on by the wonderful synthetic model that was generated by Marion and Pilar, for whom I think we all express a great deal of gratitude for everything that you guys have done in kind of coordinating this and getting everybody back on the same track. As Alan put it, I think he said it really quite nicely, and that was that for the first time he's felt some degree of comfort in the fact that a lot of different codes were producing pretty much about the same results, which actually was a bit different than he would have said a month ago when he saw, I guess, some of the first results of this. But you know, by the time everybody...
We always mine and yours coordinate systems and north down.
And, you know, really, I think that was sort of the major issue here with a lot of these codes, was just sort of, you know, the sign conventions for the impedance and rotations and which coordinate system everybody is has been using. And the fact that the results of these different codes were really pretty much comparable, I think, is probably comforting to everybody, that we're have progressed much since 10 years ago when a lot of these things were looked at. So maybe some of the discussion points are in here. So we've just kind of put together a few things that we might want to think about, and some of these might deserve some in-depth discussions, some more, some less. But I think one of the things that did come out of what Marianne and Pilar put together for that forward modeling was the difficulty that they had in trying to simulate results from everybody, and the need for all of us to adopt a particular format. We should all be working somehow with a final format of data exchange so that everything can be compared. So irrespective of how we're doing things, how
it is.
So that's a good point. So there's two things. Maybe let's just talk about this first, and then we'll come to the models, which I think is important to me. Is EDI format the thing
not
that we just...
Not to go. Everybody hates it, but it's the standard.
So,
there's a wonderful format that's much better out there called J format.
J,
what is that? J, I can't remember. Some brilliant guy years ago. But I've got all sorts of PW to EDI and J to EDI and EDI to RLM and all sorts of converters.
So are those on MTNet?
They could be. We could have a conversion page, but I still think the community really benefited
so maybe that's a pretty straightforward issue. Does everybody know what EDI format is? So, I guess so. Okay. Then the second aspect is models. What would people like to see about that? Uniformity.
Are there not international standards? I mean, there's all sorts of codes for modeling, all sorts of bloody things. You know, do you think of the standard model file format?
Aaron, you want to just let people know what things come about, and we'll put these up, but should have somebody kind of record key items.
That's CDF. Well, we've got our 3D visualization package that we use in the users' next CDF, and then the slicer dicer that we use in CDF.
Yeah, so a format like that, which might be difficult at first to start once you use it, and then if your models can be read by other.
The attraction to modelers is going to be an effort to get it, but the attraction is there's all sorts of visualization codes that suck in next CDF. I mean, you've all got your own little packages, but you know, there's universal packages out there for slicing and dicing and movie making, and they're not their own. A lot of them use next CDF.
So instead of inventing a new one, it makes more sense to use something that's already well supported. Yeah.
So which is this?
Next CDF.
Less
of this is not free, it's commercial, right? No, but there are equivalent ones that are free, that do that sort of thing. I think, Anna, you have one of those. You know, package that you show me. Yeah. You show me.
Do you want to have that?
So,
you know, one thing you could do, the way EDI actually came around was that the SEG struck a small working group that David White was chair of, and that small working group spent a little bit of time and then eventually came up with the report, and EDI was accepted by SEG. Maybe, you know, two or three of you in the modeling community, you might like to form yourselves into a little group and then report, perhaps one of you could report at the SEG that's coming up in Las Vegas, or perhaps another of you could report at the Beijing workshop.
Yeah, anybody want to volunteer to spearhead that? Coordinate that?
I think Ryan's done an excellent job. I'm not sure the microphone caught Marion's expression there. I'm trying to rebuild it.
I would be willing to work with someone to do that, just because it's something I might be doing
in
the midterm anyway. So, what did you want?
perhaps three modelers. Now, what might be really useful is if there's one from one an IE and an FEE and an FB principle, because your model is strictly different. Perhaps without wishing to put anybody in the hot seat, maybe Anthony might be interested.
Don't make eye contact. No, I never make eye contact.
So you wanted to just have like a proposal or something?
No, the three of you just exchange emails about what about this, what about that, and then come up with a proposal to the community.
Well, I think the idea of trying to find out something that is commonly used out there.
Yeah, Anna's got lots of time now. We've got the committee.
Call?
So what's the next CDF format like? Is it something that could be really appropriate for us, or is it something that's going to be so
stands for Network Common Data Form, is a set of interfaces for array-oriented data access and a freely distributed collection of data access libraries for C, Fortran, C++, Java, and other languages. So it supports a machine-independent format for representing scientific data. Together, the interfaces, libraries, and formats supports the creation, access, and sharing of scientific data. It is self-describing, but it includes information about the data contained. It's portable, can be accessed by computers with different ways of storing integers, characters, and floating point numbers, direct access, appendable, shareable, archivable.
So this is basically open source code.
Yeah, and there's a whole pile of routines, and there are commercial packages, like NetCycle and ISO, for viewing NetCDF files, but there's also a whole bunch of freeware.
Yeah, that has a real appeal. But anyway, that's an important issue. I mean, to be able to be able to share files.
Perhaps Randy, I don't know how comfortable you'd be with this, but I wonder whether a message should go out on TNet saying that this committee has been formed to look into another format. If anybody's got any views, please send them to the chairman of the committee.
I think Greg just made a really interesting point. We've got about five slides here with a whole bunch of things on, so it may be that we won't get a chance to kind of work through all of these. But so for stuff that people want to flip over, we can flip over quickly. But what one thing that was, and we never really got to it, right? When Marian sort of presented sort of the results, we looked at some plots of comparisons of the forward modelings from a number of different groups, and you know, some of them look pretty similar. In other cases, they're a little bit different. But I think when we're working towards comparing forward modeling results, we also have to be a bit explicit about what kind of accuracy is really required, and that. That also comes back to practical applications in the field. I mean, if there's, you know, if there's sort of minimum errors that always exist on field data, then as long as we can accurately, you know, model to that accuracy, then that's fine. So
yeah, I think most everyone probably tried to get really accurate results here. We didn't say, well, what happens if I only solve it to 10 to the minus 9 or 8
yeah.
or 6?
Yeah. We had some slides, actually. There just wasn't sort of an opportunity to kind of show that. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of places. There's your gridding, right? I mean, that's an important part. There's your boundary conditions. And then there's, you know, the accuracy with which you're solving.
So if you're looking for, I've seen this in subtle phase anomalies we're trying to invert for, we have to get down to a half a degree and really push it.
So there might not be much that, unless somebody else has
but
got some comment.
How accurately do you have to solve the fields? That's a question I'm not sure.
That needs to be looked at.
Sorry?
No, I'm just saying Greg says you want to get half a degree. Say you trust your data to half a degree. question is, how accurately do you have to solve your 3D model grid to get a half the green? Is it grid dependent? Is it, I mean, I'm sure it's a lot of dependent on a lot of things.
Yeah, it's grid dependent. It's interpolation dependent, depending where your station is with respect to, you know, the nodes. It's your definition of whether your E's are on the edges or whether they're on the bases.
But if we're going to go after subtle targets, then we've got to be able to produce corresponding accuracy, corresponding order. Otherwise, it's hopeless.
I guess it's trying to reach some kind of conclusion also with what we do, with what everybody has put forward here as far as forward modeling. Whether we try to archive all of these someplace so that they're used later on down the road. It's always good to have some benchmarks that we can continually compare with.
Well, I think it would be great to have everybody's output in a format that other people can read, i.e. in PDI. And we'd be prepared to host that here, you know, not a question. We are going to open up the website now for general access for people to see what happened. And we intend to put on the website the PowerPoint talks that we have on our laptop and also the video clips of each of the talks so that people can be looking at their slides as well as more hearing somebody giving the talk. You know, that might be, so that's one way we're going to archive the results. But also, Dimitri asked me yesterday.
Make sure that people want their PowerPoint to be up on the website. But
okay, anyone, yeah, please, anyone let me know of the issue.
I'd like to revise, I'll revise my slides
okay,
here because they're in a huge file. But
it's not going to be negative option billing here.
Yeah.
You know? You're going to have to tell us yes.
You have to opt in.
You have to opt in rather than opt out. But Dimitri wonders whether we should think towards a multi-authored publication. With basically a lot of those plots that Marion showed of the four results.
Probably
and then
be of interest
Marion to list all the various steps with each of the codes and get them into the real world.
It could be interesting.
It could be interesting.
I don't know where I would put it. Geophysics
would be worthwhile.
You think it's not really worthwhile? Marion could do that.
What would you do with that, Marion?
Well, I tell you, as you know, this workshop wouldn't be the success it's been. Simple as that. We'd be sitting around and drinking. It would just be me.
I get, from my perspective, it might be useful to have a little bit more detail about the forward modeling, you know, in addition to just the results. If you just see the results, then it's a bit hard to kind of even think about how you might reproduce them. When we're archiving things for our own purposes, we basically try to make sure that they're sort of reproducible so that we've actually got the mesh, we've got information about what the tolerances were for the solving of the system. We find that useful. I'm not sure.
I think that's a great joke. And I mean, I know that a lot of people, for example, access the Copod 2 data set, and they've accessed the time series of MTNet if they want to develop processing codes. And here we have an opportunity to put for all your different codes, all your different input models. You know, where a lot of you have been, those of you who use Verichai have been using Verichai's test model because that's what it ships with it. Well, it would be great to have a library of other sorts of models. And here we're going to have this Dublin test model in various model formats. Hopefully it's going to be superseded by the CDF in time. But I think it's a tremendous step forward.
Because that would be something that from my own perspective, be willing to supply as something that's a little bit more complete. So you'd not only have you'd have the data, but you'd have, you know, the mesh and ancillary information that would tell you a little bit about how well that was run. And,
yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't have the code, but you have a lot of the other stuff. So have at least some way of
making things tangible.
My vision of the paper then is that there would be sections that each of you would write to describe it, and then there'd be links, hyperlinks, to the archive on MTNet for further information.
I have some idea about the accuracy. I remember with Greg, when 10 years ago for induction logging, we used iterative approach. So I simulated something, then Greg was pissed off, and then he simulated on better grid. You know, it was like that. So I think.
It's gone.
Yeah. So for accuracy, you know, because I remember this, I don't know what it was, raw YX probably. We have for large periods, we have kind of discrepancy.
Yeah, factor two.
Right? So if you apply modified grid, right? Apparently your solution should be better a little bit. So at the end of this, what I could propose, or might propose, is second iteration, third iteration. You know?
Well, I think the.
To truth. Truth. You know, it should be a real clear. You have no analytical solution, of course, but if you. I don't know, Greg has so many processes.
No problem. Next point.
But, okay, yeah, so next point, this was a good beginning, but you know, it's still a simple model in the sense that we've got something that's embedded in a uniform half space, and there's a whole host of more complicated things that we could potentially think about running, comparing, and archiving. Yeah, something that's actually got triangular representation.
George Jurassic's, he's got the 3D radius of T, right? Which I find it's an approximation. And then, for, you know, if you're going to do that, you're really, and you and I talked about this yesterday, Joe, we've really got to get out the codes what we measure in the field, which is not point source E fields. You know, we've got to get rid of the voltages and get the voltage differences.
Yeah, so that's actually a point to make sure that if people are thinking about revising codes or building codes, that they have that degree of functionality.
But what is multi-scale? You mean small?
Yeah, something that combines something that's both, you know, small and large. Those kinds of models could also have implications for thinking about whether we're handling distortion, certain features, through distortion matrices. But again, what we need to have is valid models, since we can't fit them analytically. Maybe agreement among numerical modelers. If they all agree, we start to feel like a bit more degree of comfort. The answers are currently. So I don't think that's, it seems like it'd be difficult to hack out a lot of things on this at this point, Alan, but I think that what you guys have started here is really a good beginning, but we should continue that growing somehow.
And you know, the 3D field, I mean, I got a tremendous rush when I went to Freiburg. The change is now, we've been bumming along for years now, it's exponentially increasing to something that is useful and usable and will give us, you know, the field
well, all of these quantities here, and as well as a few others, could constitute, you know, a future meeting. I mean, this whole business of, you know, what boundary conditions do we use, and you know, the effect of really large scale structures. I'm not sure that we have a satisfactory resolution that everybody is happy with at this point. I don't know, does anybody have other things to like to comment on here, or propose
stuff.
An action item?
We have enough stuff to keep us busy for have a workshop every year for the next five years minimum.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay, but
make it an annual.
You're pretty fun crowd, you know.
And the weather's so nice here. How about the Grand Cayman Islands or something? Okay, so those were some of the items that Greg and I came up with. I mean, were there anything else from the forward modeling that people would like to discuss, or maybe even more important, any particular action items that are not so big that we could still put forth here?
Over this cable, cars cable. Conductive.
Blue. Well, that's been defined. Bruce Hobbs told the community, and despite what some people sat in Milan saying, the community has defined red as conductive, blue as resistive.
Well, the reason is Dunn's not so fixed. He said he was red for the target, because he's talking to people and he wants.
What's the psychology of the game? You're looking for conductors, Alan? We're looking for resistors. So red means it's hot, that's the one.
There's a report in the paper just the other day that football teams that wear red shirts are statistically more successful than those that wear other shirts.
Also, people who drive along in red sports cars, Alan, are more likely to get ticketed than people driving in blue sports cars.
Oh, I thought you were going to say pick up chips.
That too.
Okay, so then there's Thursday. There's the Thursday was inversion. And again, this was Alan's comfort level, I think, too, that a lot of the codes gave pretty much the same results on that synthetic data. So I think that really testifies a lot to where everybody has come in the last few years. Maybe discussion points. Now just a question about archiving the results for this doublet test, whether you want
to see them.
We're coming to that. We're coming to, but we're talking about the synthetic test, whether it's worthwhile to archive that or what we want to do with it. Anybody have some comment?
I mean, in retrospect, it would have been useful to have a second model that had the structures much closer to the surface.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the, having that overburden really attenuated a lot of the sharp gradients and made it a lot easier to find, so perhaps we could think of building the food, which is exactly the same, except that vertical body is out there.
Yeah,
this is very good model, yes. Come me, good model. Inversion, include this,
yeah.
Not only for forward modeling, but for inversion. Two blocks. At the surface. It's very difficult.
I guess my personal thought is that it's probably not that worthwhile archiving the inversion results. Certainly not nearly as important as is archiving the forward modeling. But when we come to the test, to that. The test example might be a little bit of a different story.
Well, it's not so easy to compare exactly, because we're all minimizing slightly different objective functions, slightly different regularization operators. We've assigned errors slightly differently. So
agree. At least then there's some kind of common thread that makes. You know, otherwise, you're just potentially comparing apples with an orange.
Exactly.
Okay.
Then we may be doing an apples versus oranges comparison because people are using different types of stabilizers.
But actually, that's probably okay,
but
right?
We're getting close. At least we can say, okay, now I fit this data to. I know you don't like one number, but to an RMS of this, at least it's a meaningful comparison between the two.
Yeah,
false.
And then the differences. You know, really can be attributed to, you know, I've got a different regularization functional here.
Or
so.
Discretize it differently.
So I. Distributing a noisy data set, I think, also comes into this, which for most people, this is still really, I think, an issue about exactly how they want to try to handle the errors. Right? I've probably come back out of this workshop with a slightly different idea than I would have had before, in the sense that given an impedance, I'm going to look at each row of the impedance and take some. You know, some percentage of that, but I think it would be really useful as a community to, you know, have a collective input on sort of workflows and methodologies for assigning errors. There is no panacea in this game, but especially for new people who are coming into this field, this is a place that they can easily get tripped up. And for, you know, the people who have been in the field a long time and have a lot of experience, to, you know, have at least some starting procedures for how you'd sensibly ascribe errors to the impedances or the apparent resistivities and phases, to put that together and to have that available on MTNet, I think would be a real step forward. So to put something like that together and then to build a synthetic data set with those kinds of errors, then I think we would actually be in a position to, you know, that could be distributed among the various groups and everybody could process those data, fit them to a desired amount, and then we have something that we could really compare the different results with. So I don't know, Alan, you want to... work together with Lausch or maybe with Randy? I mean, you're the And Greg, I mean, you're the guys that you have had much
sure
of the experience.
Does this thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Make sure you read this.
I don't think this is a really a big matter of discussion. I think that the work that's been done on the TIPR shows the importance of including it, at least in a number of certain cases, so that for people who are developing codes, probably to try to make sure that functionality is in there, I don't think.
There's a whole catechism that needs to be developed.
Critical issue for people who are doing both forward modeling and inversion. I mean, it's your mesh design. There's all kinds of questions about whether you have multiple meshes, different meshes for different frequencies, unstructured grids, things like this. This issue is perhaps a little bit more important if we're thinking about comparison of results. So we've talked about trying to make sure everybody's on the same page with respect to fitting the data to the same amount. But the other aspect is your regularization functionals. I think it's something that people need to think very carefully about, and when they're presenting any inversion, that it's really absolutely clear on exactly what that regularization functional is. And there's perhaps issues with respect or things to be thought of, whether you're going to make that whole regularization functional on the conductivity or on the log of the conductivity, because you'll get different answers under different conditions. said are clearly important as we go to that next level, including other pieces of information, bound constraints, tears in the geologic model, other geophysical measurements, geologic information, so on. Alan, as you're thinking about future topics and trying to sort of advance the fields, I mean, certainly these are areas where there's a lot more attention to be paid. The issue that came up with respect to, I guess it was Dimitri that initially raised it, the effects of the sensitivity function close to the receiver, so that most inversion schemes will try to put something up that's
for those who is not so English fluent, what is ameliorate? What does that mean?
To reduce.
Okay.
Yeah, to
this function.
To get rid of.
Dear Elf. I don't know. important items.
At that point, is it Randy had made a comment that it was just regularized more to really the problem of high sensitivity, especially when you're using sparse detectors. Your approach was to go in and filter the gradient or kill parts of the gradient where you have very high super sensitivity and reduce that.
Density, very uniform station density, you didn't have this problem. It's only when you had a
decimated so many of your stations, deleted stations are much wider apart, more sparse, that this problem crept up. Is that correct? So,
I'm just
put it into the regularization offer, you kind of remove that.
People are going to keep asking me the same things.
Yes, okay. It is sort of misunderstanding. It is not filtering. It is change of unknowns. So instead of have, you know, your nose is just like it's a small block. But we filter out it, and we're doing change of unknowns, like we're actually doing. In fact, I believe in his code, he has big blocks. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. In fact, okay, using small blocks, but they are connected through this method.
Yeah, through data. Okay.
Okay, so it is nearly the same, like instead of small blocks, you're using big blocks. It's the same idea. So instead of working without connecting all these small blocks, you bunch them in groups, low filter. So it's just. The approach is absolutely, theoretically, absolutely clean.
No,
we're working with big blocks. And putting, you know, this lambda, this different type of realization, with respect to this kind of big unknown. It's the same.
But I don't quite understand. if you use these elastic constraints, you don't bind them as you do with big blocks. It's
no, it
elastic.
Is.
Put stronger smoothness constraints on the upper layers in your model.
Yeah, it is possible.
That's the same thing, but you don't use the same smoothness operator in all layers.
I think this is what Randy is.
Because you started with just the gradient, and so you need so. I mean, this is what we talked about the other day, was that because you start with the half space and you pick your gradient and that's rough and immediately.
Yeah.
Because you don't. Since you don't go into like a preconditioned gradient direction, you immediately get rough and then you can't get rid of it.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I understand.
But this is very, I agree, it's absolutely very, this is physics of what we do in New York. So, it's this filtering, evading is extremely important. It is something that is, not presented in public, I think, in all inversion codes. So we should to say something to the public about that. We have a huge problem in the world.
No, we say it within our community.
No, but here's where it's very important to specify exactly what your model objective function is. I mean, for those of us like Randy and Greg, I guess we're probably all the same. Oh, and we put all of that information about the sensitivities and trying to, smooth things out away from the receiver. All of that just goes into the model objective function. And if that's specified out right at the beginning, then the reader will know exactly what you are minimizing, and then there's nothing mysterious.
I'm glad that you presented that result.
We talked about this a lot.
Oh boy.
excuse me.
Yes.
I would like to talk about the reduced time sensitivity. I don't understand why. Because the surface region is a place where you can get accurate results. Why do you reduce the sensitivity deliberately? My experience is that always get good results
like
it depends on what you're using. If you're using a Gauss-Newton method, or you having a when you ask yourself when you're updated Newton direction, that's a very good direction because you're incorporating all information in your hash channel, the Gauss-Newton approximation. So you have a very good direction to search. Whereas with a gradient method, if you don't do some sort of preconditioning, as Randy mentioned, you're going to have a lot of trouble because the direction isn't that good and it has very high amplitude information right up near the detector, and it's not the optimum direction. So that's why I think that you have encountered it is much of people who work with gradient-based methods.
No, you'll still see those same kinds of effects in Gauss-Newton. Inversions. I mean, my take on this would be kind of a two-step procedure. The first step is, you know, you want to validate that your code, your inversion code, is working on a synthetic, simple example, right? So you go ahead and you invert those data, and if there's artifacts there, then you might want to fine-tune your algorithm to get rid of those artifacts. And in this particular case, artifacts might occur right at the surface. So I'd feel free to go ahead and put some kind of regularization on to see if we can't ameliorate or get rid of those a little bit. At the same time, I wouldn't want to stop there. I'd want to go to the next stage of actually putting a physical model, physical variation, right at the surface, near the electrode. If the data then really demand that has to be there, the inversions should still pull it out. And I think in your case too, you just mentioned that you'd be willing to do something at depth because you feel like, oh, that's an artifact. I don't see that there's any philosophical difference between what you're doing at depth and what other people might want to do at the surface. It's a question of you deciding from a geologic perspective whether the surface, you know, should be really, you know, fairly smooth, which it can be in some environments, or whether it can be quite rough. And then you might want to adjust the amount of penalty smoothing that you have, you know, based upon how you answer that particular question. Personal opinion. Static shift. We still could use some discussion and agreement. Yes?
I mean, what you already pointed out that in 3D, first, that is not just a static shift. Should be
I should have put galvanic distortion there, sorry.
And then among these possibilities, I know it's already discussed, but okay, ideally in depth for conductivity and distortion, it's what would be best, but about distortion, you have lots of tools to recall, to correct it. Maybe for now, is the best way to correct it and then model for conductivity.
Yeah, I don't have a 3D over 3D tool. We can approximate it with a 3D over 2D tool.
But maybe you can, well, maybe not always, but you may have cases that first you have a base in some site that you can model and remove that.
Well, I mean, Laos had a template for how we might proceed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure how to really.
See, the problem with modeling, though, I mean, Greg and Randy advocate modeling now. The problem with it is you're fighting against the regularization, the smoothness, and you're giving yourself trouble, right? So why do that? Why not just invert the conductivity in yourself? You have a quality of how well you want to fit your data to, so you'll have to eventually, if you're going to model or not, you're going to have to come up with an acceptable data fit. So,
so Greg, what is your idea of these three?
Well, I'm in the camp of modeling it out, but I'm kind of, you know, biased.
But are there distortion effects that you simply can't model of? Alan, you're talking about, you know, graphitic zone that's cutting right through.
I mean, it might be. I mean, there might be structures that you cannot replicate with a local charge distribution around the sun.
Well,
I've heard of one data set once. I don't remember where it was from, but this had data where phases went out of pocket. And if you had a normal smoothing and inverted got a smoothing model, you couldn't do that. But if I really relaxed smoothing, let it put in a lot of sharpness,
so
you could. So you're right in the sense that the smoothing works against that, but that I guess it's probably in your data set you probably encounter distortion a lot more than like Greg and I encounter, which is maybe why we both haven't really seen much need for it.
Yeah.
And if we, you know,
let's say in the case of marine CSEM, where you can have significant distortion, where you can get gold bricks. The inversion process under your computational transmitter. Sometimes it is worthwhile to do some pre-filtering of beta, phase and amplitude shifting of your data before you put it in the inversion process to help it along.
Yeah.
It'll just help. That'll help the process and maybe ameliorate having gold bricks, but eventually you will get there. Either or approach.
But right. I mean, it's an easy thing to just add it in to the distortion crisis. Or not.
Right.
I mean, it's not that difficult.
But once you start that process of starting to muck around with your data, you know, you get on a slippery slope.
Well, I just think that the charges from dynamic distortion can be huge. You know, as Lau showed, it was a huge amount of the last four.
I was going to suggest that, I mean, if you're going to put some data out on the internet, take the response that you can receive with whichever model, and just add some typical distortion that you see, just add it and see what happens with it.
But I think
one of
the problems here is that some people have very many stations, very dense station spacing, and some people don't have that. And if you don't have it, then you must have distortion with it. You can simply not model it. And if you don't model it, you'll see very strange effects in your model. When I say you can model it, perhaps, but it looks very strange. You've got a cell size of 10 kilometers and a station spacing of 40 kilometers. Like, I don't know, it's a different. What can you do?
Well, I think it's a different beast for regional studies versus the main game.
But if you're going to generate a data set, I mean, instead of just taking some, you know, arbitrary distortion tensors and altering the data, should you not be modeling something at a really large scale, right? So that you've got this large scale distortion, you know, that's somehow built in, and then you model then at a smaller scale so that you actually generate the empty data, but now you've got these different boundary conditions and different physical currents that are moving in.
You don't have to make the assumption that your so-called distortion tensor is frequency independent anymore if it goes into your model.
But that, I mean, if there was that kind of a model and data that were generated, I mean, I think then that would help those of us who feel like we just can model these distortions. I mean, would help us reach some kind of a conclusion that yes, either we can or whoops, we can't do that. So I don't know who would be willing to undertake something like that, but I think that's the kind of data set that could really drive the theoretical research here and help us to some. Get some kind of a workflow and conclusion that, okay, we can either go this way or no, under certain circumstances, we have to do something different.
Those who could use the vertical magnetic transfer function.
Yes, and then we came to the secret model. You know, I woke up about 2 o'clock this morning, and I saw that green line come this way and go around and out the other side. I don't think there's a single person in this room that is ever going to forget that 10 seconds. most people got a similar result, I mean, at least as far as we could kind of see in just sort of, you know, qualitative structure, and they kind of ended up with, you know, sort of a conductive shoe. there we have it. I guess some questions, and maybe we don't want to dwell on these too much, but there's a real question. I mean, so here was a data set that was, you know, had some problems with it, right? I mean, should we have been able to detect that there's something wrong with these data, or invariably we will see other data sets that have some kind of inconsistencies that are in them. It's a matter of trying to. Pardon me?
The Earth isn't inconsistent. You know, we generated a data set which I think was inconsistent for physics, right? And it's just impossible to find a model. So why didn't
you,
like I said, I hope I wasted 2 weeks. Oh, well, I'd be able to tell him we wasted 2 weeks.
But there wasn't anybody here. I mean, you at least said, I hope I didn't waste 2 weeks. But I don't think there's anybody here that felt that, okay, we really found a fundamental problem in these data. I mean, we were all kind of going back and, you know, making some good progress on fitting the data, getting
this
kind of a model out.
We all thought some tricky model.
Yeah. Is it worthwhile to think about things that we've talked about with respect to errors and contaminating the data?
Or we can think about
set?
Generating another data set, another secret model with errors and stuff. And if people are comfortable with that, once mine gets back, is the first issue.
I would pick a new model.
I would too.
Tell me a different model. We're not going to tell you.
Yeah.
We're not going to tell you. This one is going to go do it.
Okay, good. Randy's packing up here just a second. Well, these are open-ended things, but maybe it's also potential things for another workshop, and that is, if we've got an inversion result, I mean, what are the things that we can use for ground truthing? How do we appraise our problem or our final solution? maybe constructing other inverse solutions, resolution estimates. I mean, these are things that entire workshops are made out of. But, you know, what the first step is to be able to invert the data somehow, right? With whatever regularization function you're using, just some procedure to get there. Once you've got there, and I think now this workshop has shown that, you know, a lot of people can do that. Now you can take a step back and say, okay, what do I like about that? What do I believe? What don't I believe? How well do I know this? Da 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 da. Right. But until you achieve that first step, then you can't really entertain a lot of these other things. But we're kind of there, so we can maybe think about taking the next step. Then today, quite a few things, but maybe actually from. I think Alan's comment, which he's been making for the last 15 years, is perhaps finally hitting home that we really do need to address this issue. And from the point of view of, you know, modifications to our codes, a lot of that is not so difficult. But there's still some really interesting research problems that are involved in this. So really taking a careful look at the misfits and looking for correlated errors and trying to decide if, you know, they should be taken out. There are errors that are correlated. I mean, from your model, either from your numerical modeling, you can have correlated errors. And there's, you know, dimensionality issues, things like that, that can give you correlated errors. But if you assume that the errors shouldn't be correlated, we should be able to do something to make things look a little better, and that will help us get more information.
I was thinking that this misfit that you presented, this was a nonlinear misfit in modern parameters because we divide by the predicts of energy. But do you really have to divide? Could you not just add another term to the misfit function? The misfit function might be
lots of scope for research and thought on this. I don't know. Other things that kind of came up? Mapping fractures for geothermal, maybe exploiting marine MT for hydrocarbons.
Lots to do.
No problem there.
Anisotropy.
And anisotropy, that's right. That never
moved. Now, who was it? Alan, the first day, said something about have we solved everything? There's nothing for the students to do. But I think we've shown you're still.
You are useless. You've done nothing.
You said that. I hope you young.
Is that the way you treat guests? Invite them over here.
Oh, no, I said.
Anybody else have any comments that they want to say?
Well, I would like to see controlled source codes for 2D and 3D. That I'm really interested in. And I have access to no such code except Cyrus' old code from 20 years back to 1D.
Yeah, I'm not that old.
Yeah, he's having his old code.
He wrote it when he was 17.
Yeah.
Talking about
immersion
or
modules? Immersion. I have yours for modules. Yours can do everything.
Yeah, of course.
Well, about them maybe as a